This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Russell, and today we have BFM's very own Uma Pagan, Ampike Pagan.
Hello, Cam.
And we have the return of Edin Koo. Please tell us officially what it is that you do.
I'm a writer.
Oh, come on. What is Pusaka?
Pusaka is an organization that deals with, works in ritual theatre.
Right. Okay.
And so I'm the founder.
You're the founder. And, all right, stop now. our three topics this week are topic number one, a Malaysian in Japan. Topic number two is, are we too easily triggered? And finally, topic number three, language. And so, Uma, you just got back from Japan.
Yes, it's only my second trip to Japan I would say 8 months. Like, it took me this long to actually make my way out there. But every time I go to Japan, it's weird because I find I learn so much more than in my other travels. It's not like I spend time in Japanese museums or cultural organizations. No. It's just talking to Japanese people and kind of embracing their everyday lives and cultures. And for me, on this trip as well, as I was exploring the cities and small towns and engaging with the people, the one thought that kept playing on my mind was how disconnected it felt that this was a culture that started a world war. And I was wondering why that was, right? Because obviously current Japanese culture is often associated with being efficient, being filial, being polite and accommodating. And then I thought about it a little more and I went, actually, it is the very same qualities that drive present-day Japanese culture, this idea of society, this idea of honor. And if you put it on the other extreme of the scale, can result in that harakiri, let's take over the world as well. I mean, it is actually both sides of the same coin, if you will. And I was just completely enthralled about how they've actually evolved, because obviously the end of World War II had the country and the culture so brutalized. I mean, their loss was complete that they needed to rebuild themselves and almost rebuild that identity to what it is today. Mm. And I was talking to people about what the education was like and what going to school in Japan was like, because for me, it's a constant comparison with why we are the way we are in Malaysia and why we can't keep our toilets clean. Why do we have such little regard for our fellow Malaysians sometimes? And it's interesting because young kids in school, in primary school, they're taught about things like this. They're taught about, you know, why you should keep your toilet clean, because it is absolutely essential for society. You know, this is how you treat your fellow man. Every day, students take turns to serve school lunches to their fellow students. Everyone kind of takes turns, and it develops this sense of community. They're told that they have to walk to school. You can't get driven to school. That is frowned upon.
Were you shocked every time they said these things?
No. I was shocked of how little it actually takes place in Malaysian schools. Right? We're taught about history and geography and science and memorizing math equations and all of these things. But I remember that even in my school, with the exception of that ridiculous subject, Pendidikan Moral, we actually aren't taught basic civics and what it actually means to be an active, functioning, responsible member of society. And all of this seems to be formalized in Japanese education, so much so that you see it in their service culture. And it's weird, you know, everyone, like nowhere in the world where I enter a shop or a restaurant, people say thank you so many times. I mean, arigato gozaimasu, it's constant, but it never feels like a Singapore Airlines smile. Ooh. It doesn't feel like it's fake. It feels like they're genuine, right? And I'm truly impressed by this country every time I go back.
Edin, have you been to Japan?
Yeah.
Yeah? Do these things ring true with you?
No, there are many things there that are very interesting. This idea of how such an organized and efficient society can go to war. That is maybe precisely why they
went
to war.
Yeah.
It's also very interesting to speculate about culture and its ethics and its, you know, and the notion of nation. It makes you wonder why, for example, Southeast Asia, which always has been perceived as exotic, laid back, you know, has committed some of the worst mass murderous crimes recorded in history.
Oh, correct. Cambodia, like Japan,
Indonesia.
Everywhere. Yeah.
makes me think also sometimes, though. But you know what is very unique about Japan is that it has a very high tolerance level, even acceptance level, of its idiosyncrasies and eccentricities.
Yes.
So you can be extremely organized for all of the day and then really let yourself go after you clock out.
Because there is that dark side as well.
Yes.
Which is acknowledged.
Darkness. It's no longer a quirk. I mean, there are certain times of the day where something's allowed.
You know, it's something that actually Malays have understood very well for centuries, which is that you create space for this kind of release. Mm-hmm. And that the sense of being organized and working efficiently together is not a natural state. It has to be created. What needs to be done post the ordering of our society is for every individual then to have his, you know, period of release. And it could be as crazy as you could imagine anything to be. I mean, there's this phenomenal Japanese TV series about a family. This man is a top executive, and he's typically efficient and orderly and strict and stern. And then he comes home, and after a certain time, his family tie him to a pole, and they abuse him and things.
Okay.
And this was a TV series that went on for a very long time.
It's a series,
yeah.
The plot sounds quite simple.
It went on for quite a while, yeah. I'm going to try and get the name of it.
I've been to Japan, just Tokyo actually, a few times. And just by coincidence, I seem to have arrived always at the time when they are remembering the atomic bomb
in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
And it's very solemn. The whole place goes quiet. And it's observed every time. But one of the things that sort of struck me about it, historically speaking, is that it engenders a sense of victimhood, that actually Japan and the Japanese were victims of the war, because that's all that's really mentioned of the war.
That's true.
And
history for a long time.
It's not like in Germany.
But to be fair, a lot of Japanese people didn't agree with the war. They just couldn't say anything because, like all fascist states, you would be taken out and killed if you went against the emperor.
Sure, but there are also a lot of people who did agree. And,
yes.
And it's not – the Germans have made a really, I think, incredibly brave policy of internalizing guilt.
And acknowledging their mistakes.
Which the Japanese have not done, and which is what really makes people like, say, China very angry.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Korea.
There's a good book on that, you know, Yuen Buruma's book called The Wages of Guilt, about how these two societies separately have attempted reconciliation with their past. But I think, that, you know, in Japan, whenever I look back at the Look East policy, I always imagine that, you know, we adopted one dimension of it, which was attempting to instill the orderliness and the antiseptic kind of culture.
Correct. And also
industrial post-war
efficiency,
Japan.
Yeah.
Industrial efficiency. And all that kind of thing. Yeah,
yes, I mean, we forgot that the other composite is that you allow people to go quite mad on their own terms.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also it's just a politician driving through at high speed in his chauffeur-driven limo, writing down notes of how marvelous Japan is. You can't bring Japan to Malaysia. Two very different places.
No, it is. But for me, the one thing I would like to see adopted, I mean, there's one quirk of Japanese culture that I really enjoy, which is their sense of focus. With regards to, and we've seen documentaries about this, and when you go to Japan, you eat at those restaurants where, you know, if you go to a restaurant and it's just a tempura joint and all they do is make tempura. And there is such a great sense of focus in making this tempura that it's the best damn tempura that I've ever had in my life. Or it's this one place that just does sushi or just does, you know, the guy spends 5-10 years of his life perfecting the egg, the tamago, right? And that sense of focus is really interesting because, you know, whether you're a writer, an artist, a filmmaker, whatever, I think that sense of focus is what is required to truly excel at your art. And they pay such close heed to all of that.
I think Japan also, you know, adopted this idea of nationhood in a very... Japan was quite an anarchic society for a very long time, yes. Right? And then it was the Russian-Japan War, I think, and their victory in it that gave them the sense that, you know, the sun was reachable.
Yeah. Well, I just find to point out, though, that it is a country, apart from a fairly small Korean population, it's racially homogenous. I don't know what conclusions we can draw from it. But we must
move on. Okay, no one would dispute that, but never mind.
Yeah, well, actually, that's a good point. But we must move on. But you're going to go back anytime soon?
As often as I can.
Oh, okay. Kind of gone all Japanese.
Expensive, though.
Yeah, man, it's so expensive.
Uma's turned Japanese. And so,
I've culturally appropriated.
Yeah, yeah. So, topic number two is me. Are we too easily triggered to be able to truly understand the people of the past? I was writing an article the other day, and I was doing some research, and I was looking at the early days of football in Kuala Lumpur. In 1890, there was a football club called the Asiatics. And as soon as I read the word Asiatics, I was already thinking, oh, okay, I'd like to write this down, but we don't say Asiatics these days. And then there was another quite witty article written back in 1890 describing a football match between two Malay teams. Because the British, the person who was writing it was British, were introducing football to the Malays. They wanted it to help stop them sort of doing nothing, just loitering and being idle. And then he described the football match, and it was quite funny. So, for instance, one midfielder was standing in the middle of the pitch smoking a cigarette, and then when the game came towards him, he kind of sort of pretends to go over there and falls over. But it's the most condescending description. And if for instance, I go return quickly to the team, the Asiatics, the captain was a man called Tek Hock, and it included players like J. Medina, G. Rahman, J. Moffat, and Martinez, which is a Portuguese...
Eurasian,
presumably from Ceylon. And it was a very, you know, kind of Muhiba team. On the other hand, the Selangor team was entirely made up of Europeans. So no, I was just thinking, when I was reading these things, like, and for the purposes of my article, I didn't have many words to spare. But I realized that the amount of words I would have to write in order to say that this is very condescending language, that we shouldn't, please don't be annoyed with me, the author, as you read this and think that I'm agreeing with this sort of colonial mindset, but at the same time, let's just have a look at... And it's like, I realize so much of my word count would be just taking up, making sure that people get triggered.
It's a sad and unfortunate state of affairs that we are in, because we feel the need to do that even in situations where we're trying to describe something of its time, in the sense that I can understand if people get triggered by individuals in the contemporary world using such colonial representations to put down. That sounds almost like a put down. But in this case, you're describing something that happened in the past. You are expressing an idea about a moment in history. And I think a reader should do as much work as the writer in that situation. And I think it's the reader's responsibility to understand the context in which this story or this article is coming from.
But the author was good-naturedly, in his own eyes, he was not a mean man, mocking the Malay. In
yeah, of course, because that...
So the reader's going to be like, how dare you?
Yeah, but that was what they did at the time.
But that was the zeitgeist.
That was the zeitgeist, that was the zeitgeist. Exactly.
We have a problem these days. You know, it's people read with so much smug, with such a sense of smugness and sanctimoniousness, so that time travel seems to be almost impossible. It's a new phenomenon. I think it's a very contemporary phenomenon, this. People used to be able to do it a lot more critically and with better judgment and with a better sense of taste.
I think so.
Just a few years ago.
Yeah, but perhaps we were more at ease with our own bigotry.
No, I don't know if we were. I don't think we embraced.
I think people fought against bigotry in far more formidable and intelligent ways in the past.
Mm. So you think then that we are easily triggered?
I think it depends on
the
what
jury
it is.
Is in.
No, I think it depends on what it is, right? I think there are situations that can be triggers for individuals who've experienced great trauma in their lives. When it comes to issues like abuse, like rape, all of these things are real, right? There are psychological effects of that. I think when writing about football in the past, when writing about colonial language in the past, I think that should be taken with the context in which it's being told. Edin and I very recently were talking about the TV show Mind Your Language. Mm. And that is an interesting TV show because it's about a room full of people, each one from a different country, conforming to the most cliches of cliches, mm-hmm. right? About mm-hmm. who they are. Giovanni is an Italian fellow that speaks with a funny accent who's constantly leching on women. Mm-hmm. Ranjit and Ali, like. India and Pakistan are constantly fighting each other, right? It is just... Oh, Su Li is walking around with a red book quoting Chairman Mao constantly.
Su Li from Ipoh.
Yeah, Su Li from Ipoh, right? But yet, I'm completely able to watch this show and laugh at those jokes, even though I know in a contemporary setting, a show like this would never be made, let alone with a white man in the front of the class trying to teach all of them English.
See, meanwhile, I grew up in England. And that show, I remember it coming on first time around. But like really soon after that, it was basically all records of that were taken from the vaults and yes. it was sort of like burnt in public. And yes. we must never mention no. Mind Your Language ever again.
Right, right.
Meanwhile, in Malaysia, it's on constant rotation.
It's funny. And, yeah. But there's a context to it, right?
It's a very big question, very deep question you're asking. I think increasingly we are having serious problems of how to grapple with history. Without having a value-based approach. I think we are getting increasingly to be a kind of nanny generation. And there's a whole industry, and it's commodified. Our values today are completely commodified. And what's right and wrong is backed by an entire industry of activity and imaging and so on. We really lack, I think, the kind of intellectual and critical distance that is needed to approach texts like those. And we are not having an argument, a debate, a quarrel about those approaches.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to stop. I couldn't put it better myself. So, everyone, I hope you listened to what Edin Kuja said. And in a moment, though, we shall be returning with part three or two here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Uma Parkin, Amber K. Parkin, and Edin Koo. Now, Edin, language.
Yeah, I was invited a couple of weeks ago to be on a panel, on a forum, to talk about the future and the viability of the National Language Institute.
Okay.
Dewan Bahasa dan Pustaka.
Right.
Who, of course, for decades was such a formidable presence in our life of education. And today seems to be really a marginal organization that nobody pays very much attention to and is often criticized for having been so responsible for the deterioration of the Malay language in all aspects. In all aspects, its standing in collective life, in its approach to linguistics and things like that. Now, what was very interesting to me was the whole discussion was about the institution and very little about the language. And one of the points I made was that we need to see the Malay language in at least three different ways. What is the place of the Malay language in national collective life? If we have one at all, given the nature of nation states everywhere these days, where does the Malay language sit globally? Where is its place? I mean, it is spoken by a huge number of people, and it's increasingly also starting to contribute towards, literature in significant ways and, overall interest in ideas. But third, I think the very important question that all languages are grappling with today, is language even important? Because even in a place like Japan, there are linguists and there are language historians who are very, very worried about the future of the Japanese language in terms of its literary dimensions, and that there are many Japanese who are wanting to learn English. And they don't want to learn English in a literary sense. They want to learn basic communicative English. And then there's, of course, language that is suffering under... the age of the phone. Mm-hmm. We're abbreviating everything. Yeah. Words even count. Mm-hmm. And so my presentation was attempting really to grapple with, what the future of language is. In our context, of course, it's highly politicized. And while nobody really has made any effort to, instill the Malay language with a sense of belonging, we are all hyperventilate when an issue like the whether the AG can speak Malay is thrown to the front.
And you're right, the political dimension of the Malay language is probably what the everyday Malaysian gets exposed to the most, because it makes the headlines all the time, right? With something as silly as whether or not the AG can speak Malay as being a call to protest, to whether it should be used to teach math and science in English. I mean, that's been a question that we've been debating since the last time Mahathir was in power, right? And what I find really weird about that is the everyday person is not talking about the literary dimension of the Malay language. It's not talking about the Malay language in the global context, or even its use within our Malaysian society on a day-to-day basis.
Yes.
No one's having those
conversations. It's a major problem because, you know, a national language is shrouded in so much of an idea of romance. Okay, so you can have a national language, which is Malay, in Singapore, that is not taught in schools, that nobody speaks, that nobody believes
They sing the national anthem from time to time.
They sing the national anthem, yes.
But in Singapore, it is not the one and only national anthem.
No, they got three,
right? One of three.
No, it is the national language, and then the rest have the same kind of status, but it's not regarded as the national language.
You're right, they have special status.
They have special status.
But Edin, you spend a lot of time up in the East Coast in Kelantan. What is the relationship with the Malay language there, where it's a very strong dialect that is spoken?
My problem with all this kind of rhetoric that is then hollered and shouted at in the most vulgar ways in the inner sanctum of the court is that it's actually totally void of anything apart from political posturing, when actually there has been so little done to kind of give muscle to the Malay language. Malay language is an incredibly beautiful language. It is very cosmopolitan. And that is a problem already for nationalists. So they have, for over generations, attempt to expunge words.
Yeah.
And when you expunge words from the Malay language, you expunge entire experiences from the Malay language. So there's a real element of alienation. I think with people like the East Coast, for example, or most ordinary people, there is a real love and belief that Malay should be the national language. But nobody really has an understanding of how it's supposed to function. So even if you go to the common ground, I find that the issue of language is an issue that is held very closely, in particular for the Malays, for very symbolic reasons. But when you begin to deconstruct it, then every Malay wants their children to know at least three languages. Unfortunately, Tamil is not considered here, you know, very sadly. But everybody...
It will.
Tell
it
you,
will.
The
yes.
finance minister didn't even bother... translating it into Tamil, Chinese and Malay, English, whatever.
Most Kelantanese, for example, have no problems and in fact are starting to send their children to Chinese schools to learn Mandarin. Mm. But if you ask them, you know...
That's a very practical consideration.
It's a very
though.
Practical consideration. So there is a chasm, or there is a kind of schizophrenia between the romance of a national language and, you know, the practical...
But I wonder if Dewan Bahasa itself is an indication of the clashes of cultures, as it were, because its history lies in very much an Indonesian intellectual tradition when Bahasa Indonesia, I mean, Indonesia got independence before Malaya, Bahasa Indonesia was being created and spread throughout, say, Java, where it is not, I was going to say an indigenous language, I mean, they speak Javanese in Java. And it, in turn, comes from a sort of a Dutch and French tradition, like the Académie Française, where language is, words are considered, and is this an official word? Is this the way we officially speak our language?
Yeah.
Whereas in the Malayan-Malaysian tradition, coming to say, or again from a British past, there is no such thing. That language is not policed. The language can evolve as it evolves. And so you have stuffy people in the universities who say, oh, it's a terrible way to use language, but no one can contest, no one can argue categorically that this is the way we speak.
Yes.
I mean, because Shakespeare comes along and he invents hundreds of words, and that's okay.
Yeah.
So by having a Dewan Bahasa, is a Dewan Bahasa a Malaysian, truly kind of a Malaysian thing? I mean...
No, all agencies did this. And in Malaysia also the dynamic is interesting because the Malay language is evolving.
It's evolving,
It's evolving in, you know, the indie publishing culture that doesn't care about the Dewan Bahasa.
It's a lingua franca.
But we have to acknowledge, you know, multi-level things going on. Of course, the Dewan Bahasa is so much a result of internal laziness and real cultural rot within institutions of that kind, and corruption. So it needs to be spoken of at that level.
And also a mentality of policing the language.
Of policing the language, yeah, which is very much a political one. I'll give you a good, interesting example. During the PPSMI debate, I had interviewed Dr. Mahathir, who was the Minister of Education when the National Language Policy was introduced. He was also known to be a very stern one about making sure that everybody and all kinds of business was conducted in Malay. And then he flipped almost 25 years on. Mm. And when I asked him, he said it's not that the Malay language isn't able to keep at pace with development, but that the agencies that were given this responsibility, abdicated their responsibility, and so now the language has been left behind. Hmm. How do you translate medical terms, for example, that change every 2-3 months in the British Journal of Medicine or whatever?
So he too made a practical consideration.
Yes, also made a practical consideration. So my take about language, and I think it's something that needs to go on in the heads of everyone, is language is played in so many dimensions. And our conversation about language is not occurring on multidimensionally. We tend to be focusing only on the practical. How far can my son get a job? What's language is good for business? Mm. In the meantime, we are producing an entire generation of stutterers who can neither spell, cannot speak, swallow all their vowels, and have no appreciation of language beyond the communicative at all.
But this is where it comes in. The question of value is often not talked about in the right way, because when we think about the value of a language, we always talk about the economic value of the language, mm. right? Like you said, whether someone can get a job just because they're masterful in BM, right? What does that mean in the globalized world, blah, blah, blah? And, until the age of 5, I couldn't speak a word of English. I could only speak Tamil. Yeah. And then I learned English and forgot a lot of my Tamil. And then I relearned it as a preteen and then as a teenager. But the concept then was, of course, my parents were telling me, well, it's a part of your identity, it's your mother tongue, how could you forget this, etc. And I still truly didn't appreciate the language. For me, the value and appreciation of the language came later through movies, literature, poetry, all of that stuff. And then you feel left behind because you're like, I don't understand all of this. And, having it translated into English doesn't mean the same thing. Yes. And we never talk about the value of the Malay language in that sense, the value of the poetry or the English. I mean, learning BM has to be more than just about its economic consideration.
Yes.
People say, oh, learn Chinese. Because why? Well, because, in 10 years' time, they're going to rule the world, so you better know some Mandarin.
Precisely. Gunawan Muhammad made a very very, very good remark about both the Malay and Indonesian languages. And increasingly over the decades, these are languages that have come to be anti-synonyms, when they're originally and innately languages that are full of synonyms.
Right.
So one word could mean sometimes 12 contrasting things.
Right.
And so you have them in pantun. They have, such genius in pantons and things like that. But they may not have any kind of direct practical purpose.
Right.
And so today, a language of that kind is seen to be not useful or purposeless or playful and so not relevant to our lives, which is incredibly tragic. Because if you fall back on that great text, the Kama Sutra, language is very important on three levels. One is for transaction, that you do business and give commands and whatever not. The second is for communication, is to express feelings and your ideas.
And the third is for a good time.
The third is for expression, for a good time.
Yeah, for a good time.
Yeah. And we've reduced language to the first experience and nothing else. Mm.
Well, we must move on, but I do briefly wonder what this conversation would be like in India, say, what people would be saying there. I mean, in the parliament,
where there are so many dialects.
Yeah, and in parliament there, one can speak in one of 12 or so languages, including English.
You can. However, there is a very strict employment of that language when it comes to culture, television, arts, and, because they too have a censorship board that actually polices.
And increasingly more powerful.
Yes, that actually polices the use of the language. Right. For example, in Indian movies, Indian TV, you can't say Bombay, you have to say Mumbai. They're very specific in these kinds of things. Yeah. So even their language, even Hindi and Tamil, get policed at that level as well.
And in China, there's a really strong policy to basically try and extinguish all those old dialects.
Correct.
And you switch on the Cantonese news and it's all in Mandarin.
Which is also happening here, right? That's why we are losing dialects, Chinese dialects, generationally, because everybody is getting Mandarinized.
So we must move on, though. Big topic, though. And we've come to the last part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something that might we think might be of interest. And I go first, don't I? Uma goes first.
So I am going to recommend something old, because I started rewatching it. MASH. So every few years, I go through this cycle of rewatching MASH. Not the film. I mean, the film's great. The film's a masterpiece. However, for me, I got into it even before I saw the film with the TV series with Alan Alda, because I think it's one of those rare occasions where a TV series actually grew this idea that was based on a film and kind of took it to different places, right? And if you haven't seen it, it's set during the Korean War. And the MASH, of course, is a mobile medical outfit and featuring Trapper John, Hawkeye, Pierce. And there are two doctors that are constantly drunk and trying to make the most of being stuck in a horrific situation. And it feels fitting to watch it again now when there is this suffocating feeling of dread all over the world. And I just think it has some of the most astute writing, because obviously every episode is contrasted between people being brutalized by the war and individuals who have no way out but to make jokes in the face of it and get drunk in the face of it, right? And lech on women in the face of it. But, you know, it is a series of its time. But I think it's got some really powerful... It's got some really powerful writing. There is one particular episode, and I can't remember the episode... I can't remember the name of the episode now, but I just watched it. And essentially, Hawkeye is stranded with a Korean family, and he cannot speak the language. And the entire 24 minutes is him trying to entertain himself and the family. It's a one-man act that is an absolute masterpiece in comedy writing. And it's just absolutely brilliant. Yeah.
It's fantastic. And it gets better. It gets better as years go by. And Alan Alda is one of the most unrecognized geniuses of cinema. Of the past 50 years.
I agree.
It's really remarkable.
The show itself actually lasted longer than the Korean War.
It did.
That's right.
So eventually they thought, we better stop doing
this. And at the time, it had the most watched finale in U.S. television.
And it was very sad, the finale.
Very sad.
Very sad.
You see, I grew up in England, and we watched MASH, and MASH was very popular. But the thing was, it was shown without the laugh track.
Right.
So when we watched it without the laugh track, it was like a drama with kind of like, comedic qualities.
Yes.
Then I watched it with the laugh track. And I was like, what the hell is this?
Yes, it's
is
very
this
weird.
To be a comedy?
So I have it on DVD, and the option, you can actually remove the, you can have it with the laugh track or without, which is quite amusing.
With the laugh track, it's like, what's going on here? That's not funny.
Because, you know, American audiences need to be told when to laugh.
Yeah. So that's MASH, the TV show.
It is.
Okay. So my recommendation, in honor of Uma-san and his return from Japan, is a Japanese TV show that came out recently called Miss Sherlock.
That's right.
And it's very much about really the BBC. Benedict Cumberbatch is the absolute inspiration for this show, down to the music and the kind of the way they play with graphics and all that sort of thing. But it's very Japanese and at the same time, and it's an almost entirely female cast. I noticed even all the background extras are women. And
Set in Tokyo,
but a kind of different Tokyo. Tokyo you've not really seen before. The rooms that they're in are quite old. They're sort of musty.
It's like Tokyo inspired by 221B.
Yeah. kind of a Tokyo that Conan Doyle might recognize. But it's and in a way, the Sherlock character is less important than the Watson character. It's almost her show. And I really liked it.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Same here. I thought just the Japanese take on Sherlock Holmes, and also what was interesting about the show in particular is it borrows from the Benedict Cumberbatch and also the Conan Doyle Holmes, this idea of him being a weird misfit in society. And that's almost funny to watch in Japan, because where everything is so proper. And she stands out as being the weirdo doing crazy things, and the rest of society are like, you can't do that. What are you doing? You know, why are you being so rude? And that's quite cool as well.
So that's my recommendation. Miss Sherlock. Miss Sherlock.
Miss Sherlock and Watson is Watto-san, which is, I thought was just, when that happened in the series, I actually pumped my fist in the air and I was like, that is so smart.
And Moriarty, it also says Mori.
Yeah, it's Mori something. It's great.
Moriarty-san. Sorry.
Yeah.
Edin, what's your recommendation?
I don't know. I would suggest people to go and dig up their father's or grandfather's libraries and find any one of those early instruction manuals on the Malay language written by colonial administrators.
Oh, those are the best!
They are very good. Because today when the Malay language, the place of the Malay language is being debated so in such a fiery way, it's good to appreciate what the language actually is. One of great nuance and metaphors. When you fall back on one of these manuals or learn Malay books for it, it's almost like entering a fairy tale world where you're supposed to read signs and symbols, and the way they instruct you to do that can be very funny. Hmm. Not as patronizing as I thought it was, or I used to think it was, but also gives you a sense of how the language was perceived then.
At the time.
Yeah, which is so much more attractive and so much more, I think, literary.
I have a copy of a book called Malay Made Easy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Malay Made Easy.
Yeah, I can't remember the author now. And it was meant for colonials who were coming to Malaya for the first time, and they had all the key phrases, but of course, of the time, right? Yeah. So one of the things was like, boy, fetch me my purse, which was translated to, oi, Kling. Umbil back, ma'am. Because obviously the boy was an Indian fella, right? So of the time, that made perfect sense. It was hilarious. Like, I'm reading all of these translations, and it's really, really funny.
And I tell you what, you know, it gets its phonetic spelling in those days,
yes,
which I think is fantastic, and I think we should have maintained. But, you know, I have an ambition one day to write an entire novel using that old phonetic spelling.
Old spelling, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it had direct translation.
Piggy minum. Gin-tonic.
Gin-tonic, yeah. But direct translation of phrases that you might need, like literally one of the phrases that translates is, Malays are lazy. That was one of the phrases in this book, right? And I'm just like, in which context would someone need to know Malay? The Malay translation for this, right? It's a great little book.
I guess if you didn't want the Chinese people to know what you're saying.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe.
Bizarre. Okay. So go check out you can find all these things pretty much online.
Online,
actually, yes. You can.
Especially at archive.org.
Yeah.
Which is a great place. But by the way, I don't know, quickly, I really want to say, I did some research on the language in Hawaii and the similarities with the Malay language, because it's essentially the same roots.
Yeah.
And how many words came from there. But you get, by honing it down, you find the kind of the basic core of the Malay language. Mm. So words like, you know, earth, eye, water, pig.
Right.
These really basic things. And then when that migration started, then you started getting more Portuguese and English and everything kind of.
Yeah, and of course, the Malay-Indonesian diaspora is so wide, right? So in terms of understanding, I mean, we can understand Indonesian, I suppose, if we go. But Tagalog is also, if you sit through a Tagalog play, you can understand quarter of it easily.
Yeah, which wouldn't mean that you'd understand the play. You just might get a quarter of the words. I've been in this situation.
I've been too. I guess we had very different experiences.
Okay. All right. So anyway, so that brings us to the end of this week's show. And it only remains for me now to thank special honored guest, Edin Koo.
Thank you.
Do you have any shows that you'd like to tell us about that you're putting on?
Only in September.
Well, tell us.
Yeah, we are getting a great Comanche player from Iran.
Obviously, I know what a Comanche is, but you know, for our listeners.
It's a traditional Persian instrument that is closely related to the Malay rabab. He's a great artist, a Grammy Award winner with Yo-Yo Ma, the Silk Road Ensemble.
Very cool.
And he's an artist with my favorite record label in the world, ECM.
Okay. And Uma Pagan, Umke Pagan.
Thank you very much, Cam.
Thank you. Welcome back to Malaysia Land.
Welcome back to Malaysian Toilets.
And myself, Cam Rastlan. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.